Welcome to Purple Politics Nevada. I'm your host, Lucia Starbuck. The name refers to the fact that the state isn't red or blue, it's both. 1 month before the Democratic National Convention, President Joe Biden announced he was no longer seeking re-election. He immediately endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris, and Democrats across the country and in Nevada have rallied behind her. Today, I'm talking to a political science expert and historian to add context to what the president's decision means, and with delegates as they prepare to head to Chicago. This includes Attorney General Aaron Ford. I spoke with him after he returned home from seeing Democratic presidential nominee Harris's first event with her recently selected running mate. Thank you so much for joining me, Attorney General Ford. So earlier this month, Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris officially chose her running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. They first appeared together at a rally in Philadelphia, and you were there. What was that like?
It was ecstatic. It was fantastic. Your audience can't see me, but you see me smiling. I have a hard time stopping smiling because it's such an exciting time for our country, for all of us who are looking forward to, as Walz said, seeing joy again. And so I'm so excited about that.
What does Walz do for Harris's ticket, and how can he appeal to Nevadans?
There's so much that Governor Walz does for the ticket. He is bringing a great background in public service, his military background, the fact that he was a former teacher. He has demonstrated the compassion and the competence as a governor, as a chief executive, looking out for all the residents of Minnesota. And I'm so proud and so delighted to have him as our nominee for vice president.
Republicans have been quick to point out Walz's delayed decision in calling the National Guard in response to rioting that took place following the murder of George Floyd. Businesses burned to the ground. Do you think this will hurt him?
Hindsight's always 20/20, and people can always Monday morning quarterback decisions. The former president called out the National Guard on peaceful protesters. The fact that Governor Walz wanted to ensure that he was making informed and good decisions around a very tumultuous time in our history seems to me to make a lot of sense. Mr. Trump himself actually commended Governor Walz on the way that he handled the riots that arose after the George Floyd murder. People are using this as a talking point because it's politics as usual.
Harris has become the first Black and South Asian American woman to be a presidential nominee. How meaningful is this for you and the country?
It's very meaningful. The first thing that comes to mind is something that both she and I have said about our respective positions, because as you know, I'm the first African-American, Black American to be elected to statewide constitutional office in our state here in Nevada, and the first to hold this office of Attorney General. And she and I have both said, we may be the first, but we won't be the last. And that to me demonstrates the type of mindset that she has about this, understanding that there are people looking up to her in this country who marvel at the fact that someone who looks like her, coming from a background she comes from, who is a woman, can maneuver through the difficulties of circumstance, to use that phraseology, and be unburdened by what has been and ultimately become the president of these United States.
At the National Association of Black Journalists, former President Donald Trump mocked Harris's heritage, saying she's always been Indian, she just became Black. Opponents are quick to pronounce her first name incorrectly. How does it make you feel to see this racist and sexist backlash toward Harris?
You saw my smile drop immediately to a frown as you brought this up. I see it for exactly what it is. And it is, as you've said, racist and sexist to address Kamala Harris outside of her name. Pronouncing someone's name correctly is a matter of respect, right, at a minimum. But mispronouncing someone's name sometimes is purely an accident. But sometimes in a more nefarious sense, it's intended to erase someone's identity. It's intended to disrespect them on purpose. And she and I both, my name is Aaron. It's not Aaron and it's not Aaron. You know, I get passionate about this because, again, my name is Aaron. Her name is Kamala. Even out of respect, you should call someone by their name.
Both you and Harris have broken barriers, been the first to hold positions. So how does it make you feel when Trump says things like DEI president?
You mean definitely earned it? Because that's exactly where we are. DEI in the context of a Kamala Harris, who was the former district attorney of Alameda County, to the attorney general, to U.S. senator, to vice president. She's definitely earned it, especially in the circumstance where people like him want to deny her of her own identity and to try to knock her down a notch and keep her in her place. They may as well say the N-word with the hard R to tell the truth. But on the other hand, I recognize that it's an opportunity for us to demonstrate that we are not exceptions to the rule. We are examples of what happens when people are given opportunities to be placed on a level playing field.
Have you always been a fan of Harris?
Absolutely. She is a mentor to me. She was the first national candidate to endorse my candidacy for attorney general. But let me be clear. I was with Biden up until literally his very last campaign stop. He's shown true patriotism by removing himself from the race. The fact that he chose Kamala Harris as his running mate in the first instance demonstrates the confidence that he had in her ability to lead the country on day one.
Political science experts like UNR Associate Professor Jeremy Gelman say Harris has breathed new life into what was viewed as a static presidential campaign race. I spoke to Gelman and the rest of the guests you'll hear from before the walls announcement. Nice to talk with you, Jeremy. So right after Biden announced he was dropping out of the race, Democrats rallied behind Harris, including Nevada's 49 delegates who publicized their pledge support the very next day. What has this done to Harris's campaign?
So I think the first thing it did was quite practically, from a Democratic Party rules standpoint, make her the person who's going to be the nominee. It kind of put to rest a lot of the more fantastical ideas about how you might have an open convention, lots of people running. I think the second part of it was it made her campaign viable quite quickly. People needed to know who to give money to, who to start volunteering for, what sort of signs or t-shirts to make, maybe not officially. That sort of coordination happened quite quickly. The amount of money she's raised in just a few weeks is pretty incredible.
It's funny that you mentioned t-shirts and signs. In July, I helped cover an event with local Democratic elected officials, community members, where they packed the Washoe Dems headquarters in Reno in support of Harris. It was a very basic white poster, just her first name on it.
You know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or you don't care at all, there's sort of this almost charming aspect to this, where these are usually so coordinated and so put together. And the fact that a major political party is trying to figure this out on the fly 100 days out, you get a real indication, I should say, of how maybe surprising this was, even for people on the inside, how even Republicans might have said, oh, Democrats were thinking about this all along. It's pretty clear they weren't.
How else have you seen her messaging so far, and how is it different than Biden's?
The people I know who are Democrats are getting texted a lot more than they used to be. They tell me it's kind of incessant at this point. And this might be that the Harris campaign isn't maybe as built up in terms of digital advertising or TV advertising yet, and this is a good way to reach people. You also get a sense of a difference of tone. Biden had that very sort of somber defending democracy tone that likely resonated with Democrats who were quite nervous about a Trump presidency, how it resonated with people whose main issue is maybe not the political system per se, but the economy or healthcare. It's hard to know. Kamala Harris is running maybe a little less of a serious campaign, not in the sense that she's not a serious candidate, but she's putting out these press releases every day that are raking Trump and Vance over the coals, but in sort of like a comedic way, right? Something that the Biden campaign would never do. And so I think this is probably a reflection of her trying to stand out as maybe a younger candidate. But among Democrats, it sounds like it's resonating a lot more. You get a lot of these vice presidential candidates that she was choosing from parroting similar lines, right? Tim Walz is talking about Republicans being weird. Let's take the other side a little bit less seriously.
Some people have called for more of an open process to pick the Democratic presidential nominee. What do you think would have been the most Democratic way to go about this?
I think the way Democrats did this is probably the best version for their party. The job of the party is to pick a candidate that they think can win the election. And it's not necessarily to do it in any particular way. People who are complaining about this are probably not getting the exact person they want to be the nominee. I think the easy response to that is the person they want hasn't thrown their hat in the ring. That probably reflects that a lot of important and powerful people in the party immediately back Kamala Harris. Frankly, she was probably going to emerge from this process regardless. So if you're an ambitious Democrat who maybe wants to be president one day, why throw away your career by making this really difficult for the Democratic Party and potentially losing them an election?
Who do you think Harris should try to get in Nevada right now? Who hasn't made up their mind?
It's probably folks who maybe have made up their mind but aren't sure if they're going to vote or need to be reminded to vote. This isn't something that consumes people in the way that it consumes you and me necessarily. And, you know, if you ask people when election day is, like, yeah, you know, it's in the fall, November sometime, right? They don't do this all the time. And so a lot of where Harris can increase her margin is likely reminding reticent Democrats or just less attentive Democrats to say, you know, that ballot's been on your kitchen table for 2.5 weeks and you kind of have to send it today.
What kinds of things are going to be on your radar heading into the DNC and beyond into November?
This sort of surge in attention that Harris gets, the analogous version is presidential primaries. When a high profile candidate declares, oftentimes they get a lot of pretty positive press for a while, which I think Harris is still in that cycle for the most part. And then there's usually this discovery phase where controversial opinions or views that candidate once held, or maybe things they did that they aren't running on intentionally, come out. And then there's, you know, sort of this decline phase. Harris probably won't enter the decline phase, but I think she's entering the discovery phase where people are really examining her record, not really as vice president, because I think a lot of people attribute that to Biden, but as senator and attorney general when she was in California. And then there's the convention. Obama's there and Biden's there and Clinton is there. And, you know, they're all hugging Harris or whatever. And, you know, that's kind of its own sort of thing. What level of discovery happens after the convention will be really interesting. The other question is how Trump responds to or is treated by media, by voters in terms of public attention going into this. Harris, for the first time, has really taken the spotlight off of him since he ran in 2016. He is not the lead news story. And so how he attempts to reassert himself as running the news cycles will be really interesting. And oftentimes he defaults to saying controversial things. Certainly he'll try and be attacking Harris, but what lands, what doesn't land, what's able to put him as sort of back at the center of attention. Can he put a dent into sort of this momentum that Harris seems to be having right now?
For Erica Roth, a delegate, Democratic candidate for Assembly District 24 in Reno, and a public defender, she's ready to see the country's first woman president. Nice to talk with you, Erica. Harris has become the first Black and South Asian American woman to be a presidential nominee. As a woman, what does this mean to you?
It's historic, and quite frankly, it's about damn time. I am so ready to have a woman lead this country, to have a woman as competent as Vice President Harris. And I think that there is no one better to beat Donald Trump than a woman in this election. This is a man who has been found liable for sexual assault, who was caught on a hot mic talking about sexually assaulting women. This is a man who has said he is responsible for overturning Roe v. Wade. And I cannot wait to watch a woman beat him in November.
Biden announced on a Sunday morning, a month before the DNC, that he was dropping out of the race. What was your initial reaction to that?
There was some sense of wondering if it was coming and being a little prepared for that, playing through that scenario. And of course, feeling a little nervous because this is historic. But I think so quickly after that news came in, I just felt overwhelming excitement and I could see how fast that was spreading. Any worry or fear really dissolved pretty quickly because I could immediately feel the energy around Vice President Harris's campaign. And that's a campaign that is looking to the future, projecting a message of hope and optimism about what this country is and where it's going to go.
And why are you personally backing Harris?
Everything that I've just said, and I want to say that President Biden has been, for me, the most consequential president of my lifetime. I have seen the policy impact on my daily life. Some of my colleagues have their student loans forgiven and been able to buy a house as a result of that. I've had seniors in my family who were able to afford their prescription medication because of legislation that he passed. But I think he also did a service to this country when he said, you know what, it is time for the next generation to step up and lead and to excite the young people in this country. And that is exactly what I'm feeling right now. It has been such a relief to really start thinking about what this country can be again, instead of just fearing what a Donald Trump presidency would look like.
When Harris was a prosecutor in California, she did a balancing act. She pushed for fairer criminal justice outcomes, but didn't push too far. As a public defender yourself, what do you think about her record and is it progressive enough?
There's been a lot of misinformation about Vice President Harris's record on criminal justice reform. Now, she was a prosecutor and she was part of a system. I put myself in that system as somebody who pushes back. But that is one role that she has held. And I think it's so important to have truthful information about how she ran her office in San Francisco. For example, she did not seek the death penalty. This was a point in time in history where Democrats and Republicans widely sought the death penalty, regardless of the background of the individual. And Harris, at a time when this was incredibly unpopular, said, I am not going to do that. I don't think it's fair to say for me as a public defender, well, she was a prosecutor, and so therefore I can't get behind her.
Some have called for there to be more of an open process at the convention for delegates to really debate and choose who they want the nominee to be instead of it automatically being passed to Harris. What do you think about that conversation?
Vice President Harris came out from the gate and she said, "I look forward to earning this nomination." And I think that she has done that. She earned my vote. She has earned the vote of our delegation. And I think it is just a testament to how unified our party is right now. And the fact that she could pull this together so quickly with so much enthusiasm is a testament to who she is as a person and a candidate. I have not felt this much energy since 2008. I feel it to my core.
You just heard from Democratic delegates Erica Roth and Attorney General Aaron Ford, along with UNR Political Science Associate Professor Jeremy Gelman. I'm Lucia Starbuck, and you're listening to Purple Politics Nevada. You just heard from two delegates who are fired up about Harris and Walz, but I think there might be someone even more excited about the convention. Aaron Sims, the Rural Nevada Democratic Caucus Chair, says this is better than the Super Bowl. Thanks for being here, Aaron. This is your first time to the national convention. How are you feeling?
I'm excited. I'm one of those nerds that I've been wanting to go to a national convention at least since I was about 10 years old. I know what to expect. I've studied these things for years. As delegates, we get invited to a lot of interesting get-togethers and parties. And the first one that I have that I get to go to is one that's featuring the band Jimmy Eat World. And I'm like, whoa, I grew up with those guys. That's wild. They're going to be playing. The thing that I think is interesting is that this could arguably be one of the most historic national conventions that we've seen, at least in a generation. We saw what could have been potentially an open brokered convention. I don't think that's going to be the case anymore. And then we also have the other controversies being the fact that the United States has been giving some support to the state of Israel during their conflict. And that has not been a positive decision for a lot of other people in this country. So we're getting threats of a lot of mass protests. It's reminiscent of 1968, what happened in Chicago there. The same year, another president decided not to run for another term. And then, of course, we saw that there were a lot of wild protests. To me, as someone who's a big student of history, seeing all this and then also being a part of it, it's better than the Super Bowl. I don't know how else to explain it.
Biden announced on a Sunday morning, a month before the DNC, that he was dropping out of the race. Tell me your initial reactions.
Relief. Let me make it clear. I think President Biden has been the most transformative and easily the best president of my lifetime in terms of getting things done in one term. But there's been just so much controversy since the start of his reelection campaign, right? We had a lot of back and forth early on within the party of, well, are we going to just try to focus on having an open primary? Do we want to see what other candidates might run? And it became clear that nobody really wanted to challenge him. He is the incumbent. But as things started to get a little bit more critical, I guess, for him over the past couple of months, many of us kind of thought that this decision was going to come anyway.
The very next day, you and Nevada's other 48 delegates publicized your pledged support for Kamala Harris to be the Democratic presidential nominee. Was there ever any doubt that you guys would stand behind her?
Not at all. For the weeks preceding Biden's decision, myself and many other delegates, not just from Nevada, but from across the country, have been talking not about who the next nominee was going to be, but who the next running mate was going to be. We all pretty much knew Kamala Harris was the only choice that we could go with. And then that was solidified when Joe Biden immediately endorsed her. As delegates, we were able to officially do the roll call and vote for Kamala Harris. She was the only name on the ballot. You could either vote for her or you could vote present. If anything, that shows that Democrats were still loyal to the president. He trusted her. We trust her. And then let's also be honest, too. There was a potential for a huge loss of funding if we went with anybody who wasn't part of the current ticket.
I covered a campaign rally for Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance in Reno. They've changed their messaging a bit, now saying it was actually Harris who's been running the country the whole time and to send your gas bill to Harris. How do you respond to that?
It's amazing to me when Republicans finally discover that some women are really strong and vocal. I remember throughout the 90s, they tried to claim that Bill Clinton was not really the president. It was really Hillary Clinton. Why? Because we had a vocal, active first lady. Give me a break. So now suddenly Kamala Harris is the one running the country. Wow. You're complimenting the crap out of us because we've had a great country for the past 4 years.
If Harris called you today and said, Aaron, how can I win Nevada? What would you tell her?
I'd say the next time you visit Nevada, stop going to Vegas, come up to the north. She did visit Reno once, but she hasn't visited in quite some time. Come up to Reno, even come out to a rural community. That'd be nice. Come out to Carson City or something. Another one, of course, would be pay attention to Nevada-specific issues.
What kinds of things do you hope the Democratic Party includes in their national platform?
I really think we need to get serious about education and housing for all. I think it's important for Democrats to remember that we're literally the only, and it's okay to say this, left-leaning, legitimate political party in the country. We incorporate people who are very far left and then people who are pretty centrist. Our base wants things like health care for all. Democrats need to get back to being Democrats again. We need to adopt an FDR-oriented platform where we continue on the New Deal, where we ensure Medicare and Medicaid are protected forever. We lift up unions and we protect workers, protect teachers, and we protect firefighters. You know, I get that we live in an age where social politics is a big deal for a lot of people, but I think that elections aren't won or lost based on social politics. Because social politics only affect that demographic. Elections are won and lost on meat and potato issues, the economy, education, healthcare, housing, jobs. I want us to have clear-cut, direct answers for all of those issues.
Do you think this point in history in the election with Harris leading this charge, do you think this is the right time to see the Democratic Party go in a more of a progressive route?
Absolutely. There's never a bad time for us to go in a more progressive route, but we had a choice in 2016, both the Republicans and the Democrats, to either nominate a populist who is very leaning in one direction for their party. The Republicans went with that option. They nominated Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders would have been that option. And we went with Hillary Clinton. She was a safer bet, who appealed to more moderates. And we did the same thing in 2020, too. I think it's time that we stand up and be okay with being a bit more progressive in our policies. I think that there's been too much in the way of scare tactics publicly. I think that goes all the way back to the McCarthy era. And, oh my God, well, if you support workers' rights, you're a communist, you're going to be taken out of your job. Wanting to have a little bit more state-sanctioned welfare isn't the same thing as the workers owning the means of production.
This moment in history may feel unprecedented, and the stakes are higher than ever. But historians like Michael Green, the head of the history department at UNLV, argue this election is not so unique. Thanks for joining me, Michael. As we head into the DNC, the country has a sitting president who announced that he's not going to run for re-election just weeks before the convention started. How historic is this?
Well, the answer is that it's very historic, and it's also a little less historic than some people think. The president who was going to be the nominee has never before announced at this point in the process that he's not running. There are two presidents in recent memory who have done something similar: Harry Truman in 1952, Lyndon Johnson in 1968. In both cases, much, much earlier in the process, leaving plenty of time for a bunch of different candidates to get in. So in this way, it is unprecedented, unique. We're headed for a Democratic convention very soon, and we don't know everything. That was a lot more common at national nominating conventions. If you go back to 1980 at the Republican convention, Ronald Reagan came in winning the nomination, but without it being clear who his running mate would be. You go back 100 years, 1924, Democrats had a convention in New York, and it took them 103 ballots. There were two front runners, neither of whom could get to the amount they needed. Well, Democrats come into this convention a lot more organized.
So exactly 100 years ago, voters were grappling with racial tensions pushed by the KKK, anti-immigrant sentiments, radio was a new form of communication, and all this following the Spanish flu pandemic. How are some of those same issues playing out today?
They're certainly playing out. The pandemic had preceded the 1920 election, but the effects are still being felt. And the KKK in the 20s, yes, they were racist. I'm not minimizing that. But they were also a lot more concentrated on immigration. Well, of course, we're having these debates on immigration. Is a second Trump administration going to round up people? Every generation debates these issues one way or the other. I also like to remind my students of this. 2 decades ago, we were in a big fight over whether people of the same sex could get married. there are people today who are fighting to get rid of that. And that's an issue in this campaign. But the students kind of look at me and say, what? That mattered? Huh? And I say, yeah. And in 25, 30 years, you're going to have kids who come up to you and say, when you were a kid, they were arguing about X. What?
What do you think that X will be?
Who knows? X could be artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, solar power, you name it.
Party conventions haven't always looked like they do today. Before 1972, the parties actually chose the nominees. Can you talk about what it used to look like?
It was much more of a white male preserve, and there were a lot of what were called smoke-filled rooms where the boys got together and decided what was going to happen. I think it was Murray Kempton, a wonderful journalist, referred to nominating conventions as a quadrennial assault on sense and decency. Yeah, they were crazy events. The networks started covering them in 1952, and people got to see these things going on. Before that, you'd have these endless speeches. Today, there are still endless speeches. Donald Trump going for an hour and a half was a throwback and a half. And they would have the roll call, which apparently Democrats are trying to avoid and do virtually at this convention. There was one convention, for example, where Nevada was very proud, I believe it was 1960, when Richard Nixon was first nominated. His wife was born near Ely. Her father worked in the early 20th century copper boom. And Nevada's delegate got up and made this endless speech in the roll call about being the home of the future first lady. Now, the other thing that would happen, there would be legitimate debates. Not everything would be in place beforehand. Sometimes there was violence, but the party conventions used to be more significant. Now they are essentially designed to be an infomercial.
How do you think historians will talk about this moment in history?
Ooh, I'm going to quote a cousin-in-law whose politics are the opposite of mine. Said, set aside politics. This is in 2016, right after the election. Isn't this a great time to be a historian? I said, no, I want to be here in 50 years to know how it all came out. And chances are I won't be. And I think historians will look at this and say, Joe Biden realized that he probably could not win a second term and felt that the risk to the country was existential. Then the question will be, did it work?
In this episode, you heard from historian Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science Jeremy Gelman, and Democratic delegates Aaron Sims, Rural Caucus Chair Erica Roth, candidate for State Assembly, and Attorney General Aaron Ford. I'm Lucia Starbuck, and you've been listening to Purple Politics Nevada.